Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well webinar and podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden, and I'm really excited to dive into a conversation today. I know many of you have reached out to me about this. For those of you who are new to the Do Good to Lead Well universe, welcome, a very warm welcome. Thrilled that you've decided to join us today and engage in a really enlightening and powerful conversation. For those of you who are return listeners and live attendees, awesome to have you with us. For the next hour or so, I'm going to have this really great conversation with Dr. Kristen Neff, and she has kindly agreed to accept questions from the audience. And we celebrated our one-year anniversary this year. We're now into about 70 or so episodes, and I'm thrilled to say that as a result of your ongoing support, Do Good to Lead Well is now rated in the top 0.5% of podcasts in the world, all podcasts. And that could not have happened without your incredible support, your ideas, your enthusiasm, you sharing the episodes and providing lots of great feedback. So keep it coming. Can't wait to continue this journey in 2024 with you. And received the Wrapped for Spotify podcasters last week or a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to be sharing this in the coming weeks. Just to give you a sneak peek, we have almost 200,000 people who have Do Good to Lead Well, either in their top 10 podcasts, their top five podcasts, and over 25,000, around 26,000 people have it as their number one. So again, an extra special thank you in advance of this holiday season. I was so excited. Dr. Neff's schedule is, I can only imagine what it's like. She just does so much incredible work, amazing research, and extraordinary consulting. I was thrilled when she was able to join us today. And I really wanted to have, as I mentioned, her to be on this podcast. So Dr. Neff is currently an associate professor of educational psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, and is truly a pioneer in the field of self-compassion research, which we're going to dive into today. She conducted the first empirical studies on self-compassion more than 20 years ago, and I've been following just her extraordinary career around this space and routinely recommend her books, her articles, her practices to clients of mine and when I'm doing speaking engagements. Dr. Neff has been recognized as one of the most influential researchers in psychology worldwide. She is author of the best-selling book, Self-Compassion. And her latest book is Fierce Self-Compassion, How Women Can Harness Kindness to Speak Up, Claim Their Power, and Thrive. Along with her colleague, Chris Gilner, she developed the empirically supported Mindful Self-Compassion Program and founded the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion. They co-wrote the best-selling The Mindful Self-Compassion Workbook. And just to show on my side, I have both hard copies. I have digital copy of Fierce Self-Compassion, as well as the hard copies of both books. And they're just awesome. Like, absolutely. I love the evidence-based nature and then so many powerful practices. So without further ado, Dr. Neff, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Craig. So happy to be here. I'm really glad you invited me.
Well, and thank you. I know you invited me to call you Kristen for our conversation, which is great. For the listeners, I'd love for you to start, and perhaps we can start with, what started your journey into researching self-compassion?
Yeah. So, well, self-compassion for me actually first started as a personal practice. I was finishing up my PhD at UC Berkeley in the late 90s. And basically, I was under a lot of stress. I had spent all this time and energy getting my PhD. My dissertation proposal was coming up. I knew I'd probably pass. But when I get a job, I mean, the job prospects are very slight. And so basically, I wanted to learn something to deal with my stress. So I signed up for a mindfulness meditation course. It was Berkeley. It was right down the street. And luckily for me, it was taught in the tradition of a teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh, who's one of the meditation teachers who always talked a lot about the importance of turning compassion inward as well as giving it to others. And I was just so struck. The very first night I went home and I just started being more compassionate to myself. I said, okay, Kristen, it's a really stressful time. And I'd also gone through a divorce, and so there's personal stuff going on. And I just tried being more supportive to myself. You know, you're doing the best you can. Take it day by day. I'm here for you. And I was just so impressed by the immediate difference it gave me to kind of be with the stress that was arising in the moment. So if you think of what the word compassion is, passion in the Latin is suffering and calm is with. Like, how are you with your suffering? How are you with those difficult thoughts or feelings of stress or inadequacy or whatever's coming up that's painful? How are you with yourself during those moments? You know, are you friendly? Are you supportive? Or are you undermining yourself? Are you critical, cold, judgmental? You know, this happened in my personal life. And then I did get a job offer, which was 2 years of postdoctoral study with one of the country's leading self-esteem researchers, a woman named Susan Harder at the University of Denver. And so I started working with her as a postdoc. And I'd started becoming aware of all the problems. The field of psychology was actually falling out of love with the construct of self-esteem. Again, just to give a definition, esteem is a judgment of worth, an evaluation. Am I a worthy person? Am I worthless? Am I somewhere in between? And so we know that it's good to have self-esteem for psychological well-being. You know, you're physically healthier, you've got better mental health. But how do you get your self-esteem? What do you base it on, right? So for instance, most people need to feel special and above average. If I said, Craig, yeah, your podcast, it's average. You're going to be, oh. And if you say, Kristen, read your books, they're average. I'm going to be like, it's not okay to be average. And that's a problem because it's logically impossible for us all to be above average. And so that's one of the issues with self-esteem is comparative. For instance, research shows why do people bully others? Whether it's little kids or on the workplace, partly to get a sense of self-esteem, like I'm better, I'm superior than this other person, that's a problem. And then other problems with self-esteem are that it's contingent. In other words, we have it when things go well, when we, you know, get that business proposal accepted, or we, you know, do really well, or we achieve, or, you know, we look the way we want to look. But what happens when things don't go so well? It deserts us. Mm-hmm. So I realized that self-esteem was a fair weather friend, because it was only there for us in the good times. Self-compassion, and we can get more into what goes into it, but it's basically just being supportive to yourself because you're a flawed human being. You know, the moment you're born, you're worthy of compassion. It's your human right. It's not like you have to go to grad school to be worthy of compassion. And so in that way, it's a true and stable friend. It's there for you at all times. So I was kind of realizing this when I did my postdoc, and then I did get, thank goodness, a job at University of Texas at Austin, and I decided I wanted to research it. So I created a scale to measure it, published it back in 2003, and then kind of the rest is, you know, history, so to speak. Now there's over 5,000 studies on self-compassion. It's just amazing.
It is amazing, and I love it. And thank you. I really appreciate the distinction between self-esteem and self-compassion, and I love how you frame it in your books as self-esteem being a fair weather friend and the contingency. And what I love about self-compassion is that it's a constant companion. It's a skill that we grow and develop. And I just think that's so awesome. And I love, again, I cannot emphasize to people attending today and listening to this podcast in the future, the tools, the skills, the techniques that are presented throughout the book are really powerful and really help tap into that. And I'm glad you talked about digging deeper into self-compassion, because I love how you've broken it down. So can you let people know, you know, what does self-compassion, what constitutes self-compassion, the different elements?
Yeah, so absolutely. So, you know, when I got the idea I wanted to study this thing, I realized I had to come up with a clear operational definition. That's part of science. And so I realized there are actually three main elements that were necessary to self, that were part of self-compassion. The first actually is mindfulness. I mean, it's not an accident that I learned about self-compassion while learning mindfulness, because mindfulness refers to the ability to be with what's happening as it's happening and kind of to accept the fact that it is happening. And so when what's happening is suffering, you know, the feeling like I'm a failure, or I, you know, don't feel good about myself, or things are stressful, or, you know, a health issue, oftentimes the last thing in the world you want to be is present with it. We either ignore it and pretend this is not a problem, you know, blah, 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 or the opposite, we dive into it, we get lost in it, we get overtaken by it. So we need mindfulness, which kind of gives us some clarity, some space to say, okay, this is happening. It's hard. You know, how can I help in the moment? And so that's really the first step of self-compassion, is the ability to be with the difficult stuff as it arises. You know, and then, of course, we respond. If it's compassion, we respond with friendliness, kindness, this desire to help. You know, in the field of psychology, compassion actually isn't classified as an emotion. It's classified as a type of motivation. In particular, it's the motivation to alleviate suffering. So we're mindful that, okay, this is hard. The motivation arises to help ourselves in some way. And at first, when I was going to create my skill, I thought, okay, that's it, mindfulness and kindness. But then I realized, actually, I was sitting with this issue. What's the difference between compassion and pity? That really concerned me, because I knew that self-pity isn't any good, just feeling sorry for yourself. So what is the difference? And I realized that the difference is a sense of connectedness to others. You know, and we know this with including how we relate to others. If I were to have pity for you, Craig, you know, I really feel sorry for you. You're not going to like that, because you're going to feel like I'm separate from you. I'm looking down on you. But if I said, hey, you know, I've been there, I give you compassion, there's a sense of connectedness, of part of the shared human experience. And it's the same with self-compassion. Instead of saying, poor me, woe is me, it's like saying, hey, life is difficult for everyone. Everyone's imperfect. Everyone leads an imperfect life. Yet not the same. It's not like we all suffer the same way or the same amount. Absolutely not. There are huge variations in the type and amount of suffering. But what connects us is the fact that we all suffer. No one's perfect. No one, you know, leads a perfect life. And so when we remember that, then what it does is it gives us, oftentimes kind of irrationally, we think like everyone else in the world is living a normal, perfect life, and it's just me who got fired. Or it's just me who has this health issue. And, you know, something's wrong with me for feeling this way. And so it's like we're kicking ourselves when we're down. And so the common humanity component allows us to remember, hey, yeah, it hurts. And I'm going to try to help myself. But it's normal. It's part of life. And that actually helps strengthen us.
And thank you. And lots of comments in the comment box about how awesome breakdown. And to me, I love that point to build on the common humanity piece. Because as an example, I run CEO mastermind forums, and then CEOs get together, and then someone goes, hey, I'm really struggling with this. And there's a little pause, and everyone's like, yes, me too, me too, me too. And I love that point, because as you say, sometimes we can feel, well, it's only me. It's just me. I'm the one. And yet we all, again, struggle and have different challenges in our life. And I love that core principle around remembering we're all part of this. We're all in this together. This is great. I would love to hear as well. You've researched this, as you said, over 5,000 studies, which is extraordinary.
They're not by me, mind you, but
yes, absolutely. That's fired lots of follow-up work. What have been some of the benefits? Because I'd love for people to, you know, what are some of the benefits that you found through your research and others' research in terms of the benefits of being more self-compassionate?
The benefits are very, very powerful, both mental and physical health benefits. And of course, the two are connected. So what we know about mental health is the first thing it does is it reduces psychopathology, things like depression, anxiety disorders, post-traumatic stress syndrome, eating disorders, suicidal ideation, for instance. And if you think of what these really damaging mindsets are, they arise when we're not able to cope with our negative emotions. You know, when the pain is so great, like if you have a feeling of sadness and it overwhelms us, we can't cope with it. So we might spiral down into depression, or, you know, some anxiety arises and we can't handle it. And so we try to fight it. And then we actually develop anxiety disorder, and on and on and on. So when we're with our suffering in the supportive, connected way, you know, okay, what can I do to help? What do you need right now? I'm here for you. what it means is you can think of it, it's not very glamorous, but you could think of it as an emotion regulation technique. You know, suffering, painful emotions arise, or difficult thoughts, we're with ourselves in a kind of balanced, that's a mindfulness, connected, common humanity, supportive way. And it means we aren't so taken down by it. But what surprised me about the research, I was kind of expecting that. What surprised me about the research is that it's equally strongly related to positive states of mind, things like happiness, life satisfaction, optimism, hope. And yet by definition, you know, built in and how I measure it, the definition is suffering, how we relate to suffering. But then I realized, well, of course, because, you know, it's not like self-compassion papers over the suffering. We're just saying, okay, this is really hard. I'm here for myself. And what we're doing is we're generating positive emotions of kindness, connectedness, and presence, which is the mindfulness, alongside the pain. And those positive emotions feel good. So it actually leads to greater happiness and life satisfaction. And then, as I said, as the mind functions better, the body functions better, we also sleep better. The nervous system is more parasympathetic as opposed to sympathetic reaction. Without going into that, basically, our immune system functions better. So we also have better physical health. So it's a very powerful source of well-being.
And thank you, and really appreciate, as you said, its impact on both sides of the emotional spectrum, if you will. I also equally found it interesting, and as you pointed out as well, makes so much sense. And then and then the physiological by extension. So once we are taking that more mindful and centered approach around our emotions and how we're processing and all of those great things, it leads to benefits on a physiological side. I've got an audience question, which I'm not surprised, and they're going to come on in. So thank you for jumping in. So Jackie said, I registered for this webinar because I was really intrigued by the idea of self-compassion. And this is fascinating. I'm a little worried, though, that I'm letting myself off the hook by doing this. Is that so what a perfect first question to start with.
Yeah, there are a bunch of very common misconceptions about self-compassion or worries, which are natural. Our culture tells us that. Luckily, there's research to disprove it all. So, for instance, research shows that, let's say you've made a mistake, you've harmed someone. Being more self-compassionate actually allows you to take more responsibility for what you've done. Why? Because it's safe to do so. It's safe to admit, okay, I blew it. I'm so sorry. If your self-esteem is invested into not hurting someone or not making a mistake, you're going to do everything in your power not to take responsibility. So it actually gives you the sense of safety to take responsibility. Also, I should mention, I didn't get into this, but I know it's coming up for people. There's two types of self-compassion that I like to call the tender and the fierce. Tender self-compassion is about acceptance. We accept the fact that, yes, we're imperfect. We accept the fact that sometimes things are painful, they're difficult. And we alleviate our suffering by accepting ourselves and accepting our emotions. But it is not compassionate to accept harmful behaviors or situations that we're in. That's not compassionate at all. That's harmful. So when it comes to our behaviors, maybe I made a mistake. Okay, I can accept the fact that it doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It's not like I am a mistake. But if I made a mistake or I'm doing something that's harmful, it's not compassionate to accept it. I want it changed. I want it to grow. I want to, you know, do something better next time. This is what I like to call fierce self-compassion, or by the way, changing a situation. The Me Too movement, you know, all these social justice movements, these are self-compassion movements saying, you know, no, I'm drawing a boundary. This is not okay. So related to the question of letting yourself off the hook, actually research shows the number one block to self-compassion is a belief that it's going to undermine our motivation. We think it's just, oh, so I got to be on the exam, or so, you know, my performance was underwhelming. Yeah, I'm still okay. Yeah, okay, so yeah, I am still okay. That's tender self-compassion. But my performance isn't. I wouldn't be happy and well. I need to up my game. And this is where fierce self-compassion comes in. And the research is very clear. It's actually a more effective motivator than self-criticism. Self-criticism kind of works, just like it kind of works to say to a child, you better get your grades up or you're grounded forever. It works. Yeah, it works if you say, I better get my performance up or I'm going to slam myself. But it creates performance anxiety, undermines your performance. It creates fear of failure. I mean, isn't it such a truism? Failure is our best teacher. And if it's not okay to fail, how are we going to learn? So self-compassion says, yeah, okay, fail. It's human to fail. But how do I learn from my mistakes? Because that's a human and compassionate thing to do. So just as an example, we just published a study with NCAA athletes and taught them self-compassion, how to have compassion for their training, when their training routine or mistakes in games. And we said, okay, be fiercely self-compassionate. What can I learn from this? It doesn't mean you're a bad player or you're a bad person. What can I learn from this? How can I grow? Which for an athlete is the most compassionate thing you can do. And their performance improved. Their coaches agreed that their performance improved. So self-compassion, in other words, being like an ally toward yourself, having your own back, giving yourself constructive feedback, actually ups your game, makes it more likely you'll succeed.
Love the comment, the observation around bringing that balance. And so I have a strong inner critic, like a strong inner voice self-critic. And you talked about the motivational side. How do those two things come together in terms of my inner critic, which is pretty loud, and self-compassion?
In some ways, you can think of self-compassion as a different way to handle your distress or your shortcomings or mistakes than self-criticism. So the voice is encouraging and supportive as opposed to like demeaning and harsh. Having said that, you don't want to beat yourself up for beating yourself up, because once we really look at what the inner critic is doing for us, at some level, it's trying to help us. We know evolutionarily, self-criticism comes from the fight, flight, or freeze response. You know, we see a problem, we've made a mistake, or, you know, we're short on our sales goals or whatever it is, we're threatened. And so our first instinct is to go into fight, flight, or freeze, but we turn that inward because the problem is ourself. So we fight ourselves thinking, maybe if I'm harsh enough, get myself in line, or I'll make the changes I need so I'll be safe. Or maybe I'll like blunt the criticisms of others so I'll be safe. Or I flee into shame, or I freeze and get stuck and like ruminate. These are all ways we're actually trying to help ourselves. So we want to be compassionate towards our inner critic. It's trying to help. And again, sometimes it kind of works, but it's actually just not as effective. Think of maybe you have experience of having a coach. Maybe you played sports in high school. The coaches that were really harsh, yeah, they got you moving, but the best coaches were the ones that were like firm and clear. No, you can do better. This is not acceptable, but I care about you. I believe in you. How can I support you? And so that more supportive coach or that more supportive voice is actually more effective than our inner critic. So we want to befriend our inner critic. We want to say like, well, thank you so much for trying to help me and trying to keep me safe. I really appreciate it. Because if we don't, our inner critic is going to think, oh, she hasn't gotten the memo. I better scream louder. So you want to, okay, I hear you. I get it. Thank you so much. And I think we're going to try to approach this problem from a little more productive and, you know, useful way. That's why all these voices are necessary, but we want to try to go with the voices that are most effective. And that is a supportive, like good coach. You can think of a mentor, good, supportive, but constructive mentor. A good mentor doesn't say, oh, no problem. If it's a problem, that's not helpful. You're paying your mentors, your coaches for that feedback.
Well, and I love that. And it's one of the core ideas throughout. And I think it's just so powerful in terms of the self-compassion research is around, as you say, befriend your inner critic. So have some compassion, curiosity, and understand and recognize. So what role is the inner critic looking to play? And then, as you say, being able to pivot and stepping back from that and saying, okay, so thanks for trying to do what you're trying to do. And then how might we be able to channel this in a different way? I've got another audience question, so which is great, from Stan, who's wondering, has there been any work in terms of how self-compassion works within a business context, like, you know, in a corporate setting, because their hesitation to adopting it, and how can we make our organizations more self-compassionate?
Yeah, there has been, you know, not as much as in other domains, but there has been probably a few hundred. So in the self-compassion field, but still a lot on workplace context. For instance, one study showed that it reduced employee turnover. So those employees who are more self-compassionate about the work stress they face, they were less likely to, like, you know, just quit their job. Reduces number of sick days, for instance. There was actually one study that showed it enhanced performance because, again, what self-compassion does is it creates a growth orientation. And there's a lot of research in the business field showing that employees or leaders, for that matter, who have a growth orientation. So in other words, it's not so much about what does my performance say about me? It's like, what can I learn? How can we grow the business? How can I grow my skill set? And because self-compassion creates a growth orientation, it's actually good for the bottom line. There's also some research showing that self-compassionate leaders, especially those that kind of model self-compassion, are more respected, right? To be able to model. And so remember, self-compassion isn't blowing off your mistakes. That's not self-compassionate. Self-compassion is like, wow, I really messed up. I apologize. I own it. But it's only human. This is how we learn. Here are the concrete steps I'm going to take to try to learn and grow from this situation. Again, it's treating yourself with warmth, kindness, and support, just like we like that when you treat your employees with that kindness and support, that it actually creates more respect. This is the thing. I know mindfulness has really infiltrated the business world. I think it's time for self-compassion to step in here. Sometimes the word sounds a little squishy. If you don't like the word, if you're a business leader, you can just call it inner strength training. Same thing. That's what we said to the athletes. The athletes, we didn't call it inner self-compassion. We thought it's not really like not part of the macho athletic culture. So we call it inner strength training. It says inner strength training, how to support yourself, how to have your own back in a really constructive, positive way that takes personal responsibility. That's what we need in business.
Absolutely. And thank you. And again, lots of fabulous comments about loving the references to the research results. Makes perfect sense that this would happen. And I really love, Kristen, how you're commenting on the labeling. Call it inner strength training. That's exactly, this is a really powerful outcome from that. And Steve has a follow-up question. Said, I love that labeling. I would love to get our organization to be more self-compassionate. Are there other tips to get executives more open to this? Are there certain practices that you've found to be particularly effective or open in a more corporate environment? It's a great question.
About 13 years ago, with my colleague, Chris Germer, we developed the Mindful Self-Compassion Program, which is a pretty in-depth training. It's about 8 or 10 weeks, depending on the format, a couple hours a week. We also have short forms of the training. I'm not really doing research on the basic benefits of self-compassion anymore. I know it works. I'm interested in how do we get people to practice it in an effective way? So one is through the Mindful Self-Compassion Program. So at the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, for instance, now we're contracting with corporate businesses. If you go to the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, you'll find it. It's centerformsc.org. So that, for instance, teams can take online training together. You can take it individually. So we offer a lot of training online, but it's most powerful, I think, when you do it as a team, because then you change the culture of the environment, or people start reinforcing each other to have more self-compassionate responses to stress, for instance. I've got the Mindful Self-Compassion Workbook, you said, on my website, which is at selfcompassion.org. I've got lots of free practices. I mean, there's a ton of practices out there. I think I've got like 20 free ones on my website as it stands, where you can try them out. But really, doing something like getting training, because again, you want to language it a little bit differently if you're working in a corporate environment than you might teens. Or the languaging is going to differ depend on the environment. For example, we have a training program for healthcare organizations where the languaging is all around particular stresses of healthcare, called Self-Compassion for Healthcare Communities. And I think they're rolling it out at Seton and Kaiser now in California. Again, because it really is a cultural mindset shift. Once you realize, okay, denigrating myself, being harsh with myself, it's no more effective than it is being that way to others. The most effective way is firm, clear, constructive, supportive, kind, benevolent feedback. And again, as leaders and employees get on board with this, and then everyone can start you might criticize yourself, Craig. Sometimes you might say, oh, I'm so stupid. I can't believe I missed that deadline. You're kind of hoping for me to say, oh, Craig, don't worry. You did the best you could. You know what I mean? We agree that actually, okay, I missed a deadline. Ouch, that hurt. Well, I care about this company. I care about my work performance. What can I do to learn and grow from this? Let's just change the way we deal with this so that it's more constructive. And it can be really helpful once you get a cultural shift that way.
Well, and I love that. And I wanted to go back to a point you made earlier, which I think is so awesome as well and relates so strongly to a period where we are right now. And you talked about as well, creating that sense of safety. And what I really appreciate around your work in self-compassion is safety for ourselves, because a lot of focus on psychological safety and how you build environments where people can speak up. And I love how you take that mirror and kind of point it inward and go, so that we can have us experience a sense of safety. So I think that's such an incredibly important idea. I have another question. These keep firing in, which I'm not surprised. So Linda said, thank you for your amazing work on self-compassion. I do a lot of journaling in my mindfulness practice. So does self-compassion come into that space with journaling, or curious to hear your thoughts?
Well, it absolutely can. It often, so what we know about mindfulness practice, you could think of mindfulness as maybe giving space to your thoughts or emotions and this acceptance. What compassion adds is the warmth and the feelings of connectedness. So that's why those three elements are there. What we know is just naturally, when you practice mindfulness, maybe you meditate or you have a mindfulness journal, it kind of naturally opens the door, because mindfulness gives space and it kind of opens the door for insight into interconnectedness to arise. And it opens the door for the heart to open and warmth to arise. So in and of itself, it may naturally engender it. But I've had a lot of 30-year mindfulness meditations take some of our training. It helps to make it explicit. You know, explicitly bring in the common humanity. In your journal, just take a few moments to write about how you aren't the only one, how this is part of being human, that nothing's wrong with you or abnormal about your experience. Take a few moments to write to yourself like you'd write to a friend. Whatever words of warmth, care, support, whatever you need to hear to feel emotionally supported, you actually intentionally do that. It's going to really strengthen your journaling. And just to throw out one more study, we had one researcher did a study where they had people wrote a self-compassionate letter to themselves. Again, the three components: mindfulness of what you're feeling, common humanity, you aren't alone, and kindness and warmth and support. Compared to a control group, people who wrote a self-compassionate letter every night for 7 days, they did follow-up. It reduced their depression for 3 months and increased their happiness levels for 6 months. That's pretty good bang for your buck. So self-compassionate writing is a very powerful way to give yourself compassion.
Well, and again, back to the research, and I'm always game for people who follow the podcast. They know I love the studies and the evidence-based nature of these conversations. And I'm really struck by, when you look at the interventions, and in particular over time, like how long these effects last. It's months, it's a year. This is when we do it. These are things that are not just beneficial in the moment, which is incredibly important. This lasts for an extended period of time. What do you think it is about the area of self-compassion that enables the duration, if you will, of these effects to last so much longer?
Yeah, well, because if you really think of what you're doing, so self-compassion always happens in the moment. Actually, all experience only happens in the moment if you get down to brass tacks. But what happens is over time, you start to realize, it's almost like training. You reinforce the idea that, okay, I've got a moment of suffering. Again, this could be physical pain. It could be stress at work. It could be the thought of inadequacy. You look in the mirror, whatever the reason is. And over time, you start to relate to those difficult moments in a more supportive, connected, present way. And then you start to realize, okay, this actually helps me cope. Again, gives me inner strength. So I'm not so derailed by the difficulty. And then over time, it just becomes more habitual. So what's happening is over time, if you start relating to these difficult moments in a more supportive, constructive way, it's going to lead to the habit to develop. It's self-reinforcing, you might say. Like now, and it's not that shame never arises. So for instance, shame, the feeling of shame, wanting to hide, this is kind of an evolved emotion. If you do something really embarrassing or shame, doesn't matter how long you've been practicing self-compassion, it's been over 25 years to me, it still arises. What happens is when it arises, I know what to do with it. Instead of getting lost in it, I know, first step, mindfulness, okay, I'm going to feel it. Wow, shame, uncomfortable. Okay, but I'm going to be with it because I know I have to. I might put my hands on my heart, some sort of physical gesture of kindness. I'll tell myself something like, this is part of the human experience. People do things that they're ashamed of, or, you know, this arises. We make mistakes. It doesn't feel good. This, I think I'm not the only one who's experienced shame. And can I be there for myself? And so that's kind of more the accepting. And then always the fierce comes in. The fierce is like the commitment to go forward. okay, how could I commit to try to learn from what I did, for instance, or try to figure out some way to grow? What can I learn from this so that hopefully this doesn't happen again? Two are always hand in hand. Over time, I've just learned that it just works a lot better. So now I just kind of, you know, it's habit for me.
One of the core ideas, it seems, or it just comes out time and time again, and you reference it from the suffering side, where you call it, you know, suffering is pain times resistance. And you just mentioned it well, again, in the recent example of acceptance. So it seems like acceptance of things as is without judgment is an incredibly powerful idea within that. Is that across the spectrum?
Yes, absolutely. So again, we have to do a little time trick here. We accept what's arising in the moment. It doesn't necessarily mean we accept this be forever. But think of social injustice. If you don't accept that injustice is occurring, how in the world are you going to commit to changing it in the future? You know, and also if you're so like, if you notice something's unjust and if you get so like, this shouldn't be, like you're so upset, how are you going to like make wise action to try to change it? So this acceptance and change thing, they almost like are doing this little dance together. Mm-hmm. So acceptance of the present moment, this is how it is. Acceptance of ourselves. This is, in this moment, the best we've been able to come up with. We're doing our best moment by moment. Most of what's happening is outside of our control. We've got some sphere of control, but the reality is it's so much more complex than our small little selves. So we accept that, we support ourselves at the same time that we commit, with this the fierce bit, to doing whatever we can to make sure the future moments unfold in a way that are less painful. I just say that because there's been some criticism of, you know, the mindfulness movement. Some people don't understand. They think it's just all about acceptance. You know, businesses, just teach your employees to accept the stress so they aren't so burned out. And then they won't complain so much, or they won't want better working conditions. Like, it's not just about acceptance. Mm-hmm. It's acceptance plus change in the positive direction, which is only possible from a platform of acceptance.
Well, and thank you. And again, amazing comments coming through the chat room on this. And what I really find is powerful about what you just shared, Kristen, is around it's accepting. So it's acceptance of me, acceptance of the circumstance. And it almost like slows things down. Yes. And now I'm empowered to make the most informed choice about where I go with this. And if I'm all wrapped up, if in my lack of acceptance of me or my situation, I cannot make optimal choices or channel my energy. And that's what I love around this, is that it is the power of it and the thoughtfulness, just taking that pause and then saying, hey, where am I going to go with this? And I love, again, one of the reasons I love hosting this podcast is because just the synergies. So we had Doug Conant, the former CEO of Campbell's Soup Company, come on, and he had this amazing quote, and it just, your observation just sparked it, where he said, I'm tough on standards and I'm sensitive to my people. So it sounds like very similar to what you're talking about, like be kind, and there are still standards to uphold, actions to take.
Yeah. And it's not kind to put those standards down or to let them slip, right?
Yes. So,
means, again, think of these athletes. You know, their scholarships are on the line. Second best is not okay. But when you blow it, whether it's business or sports, and you fill yourself with shame, it actually detracts you from your ability to do your best. It just creates all these negative emotions, and you can't see clearly. It's hard to learn when you're feeling all that shame or negative self-criticism. Another common misconception is that self-compassion is selfish. Right. Our culture tells us be compassionate to others, not ourselves. The research clearly shows that actually the more compassion and support flows inward, the more resources you have available to care for others. It's not like a zero sum game. It's actually additive. And so the reason I thought of that is another research study found that self-compassion reduces burnout at work. Partly because when you're so stressed in the workplace environment, and you become drained, if you're worried about like helping all your colleagues and you aren't dealing with your own stress, you're going to have nothing left to give. Mm-hmm. So self-compassion is actually one of the best gifts you can give to others, because it allows you to stay in the game, to be strong, to be resourced, so that you continue to help and be productive and cooperative, et cetera.
Absolutely. And again, it's why I've been so looking forward to this conversation, because it's just packed with incredible insights personally and professionally. And it brings me to the idea of, you know, in the airplane, right? You put your mask on first before you can assist other people. And in fact, not doing that undermines our ability to be there and do the things that we most want to do. And again, I enjoy and really find it so impactful, is that it's making sure that we're asking ourselves provocative questions and recognizing, okay, what is our ultimate goal here? What are we trying to accomplish? And are our actions aligned with that, or our thought patterns, or what we're doing?
Yeah. So for instance, values. So in the Mindful Self-Compassion program, we have a whole section on values. One of the things we say is the quintessential self-compassion question is, what do I need? What do I need to be well and to alleviate my suffering? Well, you don't know what you need until you know what you value. And so part values clarification, what's really important to me, authenticity. Actually, one of the strongest findings of the literature is that self-compassion fosters authenticity. Because when your sense of worth comes internally, you know, the bottom line is I'm worthy just because I'm a human being doing the best I can. Then I can say, well, what is it that I care about? You aren't going to do things that you don't believe in just so that other people like you, for instance. And so that values clarity, there's a huge amount of work on like values, especially in the business world. When you know what you care about and where your aim is, then self-compassion is going to help you reach your goals. Otherwise, you're just kind of being buffeted by the winds of whatever, the culture or profits, or without any real clarity about what matters to you.
Well, and I love that point, because again, when we think about it and reflect on, there's so much emphasis on authenticity these days, right? In terms of an authentic leadership and the power that brings, and then the trust that it builds with people, because, hey, you know who I am and what I'm about. And I really appreciate your point around values, because oftentimes, again, in my coaching practice, what are the things that people talk about when they are in a situation and then they were moved away from their values, either because they hadn't thought about their values in advance, or they just kind of made this assumption they would act in a values-oriented way. And then because of their emotional upheaval, just they chose a different path. I'd love to get your take on that.
Yeah, well, so in some ways, the whole idea of suffering, what causes suffering and what causes happiness, is you can't really disentangle that from our values, right? So like if I value earning money for my family, then, you know, getting a raise, it has a big raise, but also requires more hours. It makes me happy. But if I value spending time with my family, maybe the money isn't so much of an issue, then getting a promotion that maybe gets more money, but it takes a lot more hours, that's going to cause me suffering. So what causes suffering, for instance, is really nested with our values, what's important to us. So it's so important, self-compassion in terms of the desire to be well and alleviate our suffering, to ask ourselves what's important to me. And also forgiveness. And so, for instance, when I lead workshops, I lead this value exercise where we think about what our values are. And we start thinking about what are the ways in which we aren't living in accord with our values. But also what happens when people do that is immediately they start criticizing themselves for not living in accord with their values. So first you need compassion. It's natural. It's human. Stuff happens. No one lives totally in accord with their values. Can I accept that and have compassion for that? And then can I try to realign my effort so that whatever way is possible, that I make my best effort to live in accord with my values, with the understanding that I'm only human. People find it very, very powerful to be able to do that through the lens of kindness.
No, and I think that's such an important idea that you're sharing here, Kristen. And then also, as you say, as we walk through that process, recognizing our journey, particularly from a values-based standpoint. And I really love, and again, so many great comments coming through, that linkage between happiness and values orientation, or living or leading with our values, and how that translates to our well-being, to our emotional well-being. So good. And time is flying by. We've got about 10 minutes left. I've got another question coming in from the audience, from Wendy, who says, this is amazing. So much for me to think about, taking lots of notes. I find it very difficult to deal with negative emotions like anger and sadness and stress. Can self-compassion play a role here?
So can self-compassion help with negative emotions? That's what it's designed for. Remember, how are we with our suffering? How are we with our negative emotions? This is really where it's so powerful. So again, the first thing we do with the negative emotion, whether it's, you know, anger or fear or sadness, is the first thing we do is we're mindful of it. In other words, we give some space to it. We don't fight it, because if we fight it, we don't want to be feeling this. What happens is we intensify it. It's like we're putting pressure on it and it intensifies it. So we give us some space. Okay, I'm feeling this anger, I'm feeling this sadness or this pain. Give us some space. And then we give ourselves, well, actually, you can do either step, but let's say the next step is, remember you aren't alone. Anger, this is a human emotion. Sadness, this is a human emotion. You know, oftentimes our mind is telling us, I shouldn't be feeling this, or somebody's wrong with me for feeling this way. No, if anyone, this is the natural human reaction to, you know, life. As you get angry, you get sad, you know, stuff comes up. So I'm not alone. And if it helps, you might think of, how many other, like, hundreds or maybe even millions of people are probably feeling something similar right now? You aren't alone. And then some kindness. You can give yourself, I think I'm a big proponent of physical kindness, because again, this does work through the parasympathetic nervous system. Put your hands on your heart or face or some sort of physical touch that will let yourself know I'm here for you. And then some words of kindness and support, like, first of all, kind of validating the pain. I know this is really hard to feel this. Maybe I'm so sorry you're going through this. How can I help? Here's the great thing about self-compassion. We already know how to do it for others. We just know how to do it for ourselves. So you can just think, what would I say to a really good friend, or, you know, someone I really cared about, a dear friend who is in the exact same situation I am? And then it's easy. Oh, I'd probably say, hey, you know, it's under a lot of stress, or I'm here for you, or you're doing the best you can. You know, these naturally compassionate, supportive responses would just come up. They would just arise. So there's three things you can do. You can either just be compassionate to yourself, but that may be hard at first. So you can think, what would I say to a friend? And then say it to yourself. Or alternatively, you could think, what would a really compassionate friend say to me? Or maybe like some spiritual figure, you know, what would the Dalai Lama say to me? Or, you know, whatever works for you. We have the compassion template in our mind. And it's also part of our evolution. We're all born with the mammalian caregiving system. We know how to do this. It's also instinctual. This just doesn't come up as much when we're personally suffering or feeling threatened. We just tap into this care system, whatever way works for you. And then what happens, again, the research is very clear on this. It helps you be less overwhelmed by the negative emotion, helps you handle it, helps you cope with it. And then kind of you can think, well, what's my way, the best way out of this to move forward?
And again, thank you. And so many great comments again coming through. And I have to say, in full disclosure, in my coaching conversations with executives and very senior executives, and then we'll have a discussion, and then how that self-talk, if you will, is just...
Yes.
Can be incredibly negative and hurtful and destructive. And then I'll say, well, there's this amazing work in self-compassion. What advice would you give to someone, or how would you treat a fellow executive if they came in? And I love that you highlighted that, Kristen, because it's such a opportunity to step back. Yeah. And then the insight that provides is extraordinary. And I love that you added an additional piece, which is think of the most compassionate person you know. If they're a role model, what would they say or do? So good. Absolutely. Exactly.
And if you're a spiritual person, which many people are, you could feel free to use that, you know, my higher self, or if you're particularly religious tradition. We have these models in our mind of what compassion looks like and feels like. We can access at any point. It's like we have this amazingly powerful tool in our back pocket available to pull out at any time. And this is my life's work, just to let people know it's there. You know? And it's not rocket science. You know, it's not like you've got to do differential calculus to figure out how to be so compassionate. You know, it's just like, we know it's easy, really. We just have to remember the biggest thing is give yourself permission. It's not going to make you weak. It's not going to make you lazy. It's not going to make you unmotivated. It's actually just going to help. You know, you won't believe me until you try it out for yourself. So,
Absolutely. And to me, it's what really, and I've been following you and your work for quite some time and admire it. And to me, what I was drawn to is that the power of the kindness for yourself. And then, as you say, it's just such a natural that it's kindness towards other. And then the idea being, well, then how come I'm not worthy, capable of the same thing? And again, in that balance, so I care and I'm compassionate towards others. Wouldn't that make sense that I would be for myself? I just think that's awesome. I have a question again from an audience member, which I was going to ask as well. Just love the 20 years of research in this. What are you most excited to explore moving forward in terms of things, new areas you're looking at when it comes to self-compassion?
A couple of exciting things I just turned in to the publisher with my colleague, Chris Germer. We wrote a book called The Mindful Self-Compassion Toolkit for Burnout. So basically, it's similar to the workbook, but it's all applied to the context of burnout. Burnout is such a huge problem in society right now. So that should be coming out sometime next year. The other thing I'm doing, it hasn't launched yet, and actually I haven't been really public about this, but I'm going to go ahead and let you know. Is early next year, I'm going to launch something called the Self-Compassion Community on my website. So right now, you can go to my website, just Google self-compassion, you'll find me. You know, there's resources, you can take the self-compassion scale, you can listen to practices, but I want to offer more. So I'm going to start a subscription model community where you can take like mentoring sessions, or you can join sessions with me once a month, or you can like look at some of my past workshops. Or there's going to be discussion forums. I'm going to create more practices. So again, this is really where my heart is right now. I'm really interested in the practical brass tacks. How do we help people do this? And so that's one thing that should be coming early next year. It's not launched yet. But yeah, it's so much fun. But it's actually not doing active research at the university anymore or teaching classes because it was just too much. I decided my gifts are best spent right now doing things like helping people learn how to practice self-compassion. So that's taking my full time.
Well, there you go. Breaking news, heard it here first or one of the first.
The self-compassion community is going to launch probably in February or so. If you go to if you sign up for my newsletter, you'll get the message when it gets launched.
Well, I'll make sure, and this is for the podcast team in the background, I'll make sure they add it to the show notes for this as well so that people can check it out. And for me, what I love is and really appreciate the passion. You can just see it coming through, and I've had comments throughout, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I love the evidence-based approach that you take to this. And then you really can, for me, going through the Mindful Self-Compassion workbook, and I'm thrilled to hear it's coming out for burnout. Because it's just so systematically laid out with concrete examples and tools that you can use. And in full disclosure, I used this in this session when we had a couple of technological, I was like, this isn't the first webinar that has that has had technical issues. Okay, so now what do we need to do to come back and engage in the fullness of, and again, incredibly powerful tools that you can draw on important moments so that, again, you continue to show up. So thank you for your passion, your research, the extraordinary success. Thank you for taking the time out of your schedule today. I've been looking forward to this since we were able to connect. So this has been an absolute pleasure. And I have so many positive comments coming through. Thank you. Amazing, amazing, awesome webinar. One of the best webinars I've been on all year. So thank you so much, Kristen.
Craig, you're raising my self-esteem. Be careful. I'm going to start thinking special and above average.
The fair weather friend, exactly. Yeah, that's right. All right, everybody. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.